Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for joining the first session of today. You're at the software-defined storage dev room. We'll have storage talks throughout the day until, I think, 7 tonight. Fabio is here to start with his first talk. Enjoy.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Welcome, everybody. I'm Fabio. My colleague Salman was supposed to be as well. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it, which is really a pity because he's the guy who actually built most of this stuff. But now you got me. I'm going to talk about OpsFS Fuse Mount, what it is, and what we built it, and how we use it essentially. Before doing that, I just want to give you a little bit of a context on, what is OpsFS in general and where it is used. Kind of have a feeling that not a lot of people know about it. So OpsFS is effectively an Apache HFS compliant distributed file system, right? So the code base was forked out of the Apache HFS, and we made a couple of different changes over the course of the years, some significant, some less significant. But ultimately, there is mostly an architectural change and also some security differences between what is Apache HFS and OpsFS. Ultimately, the APIs are the same. So the clients are compatible, right? So if you look at the actual implementation architecture of OpsFS, you can actually recognize some of the processes, some of the entities that you can also find in Apache HFS. The difference is that they behave slightly different, right? So in HFS and OpsFS, you have the name nodes. Those are responsible for interacting with the clients, knowing the state of the file system, responding to the clients, giving access to the files, and so on. The difference between what is Apache HFS and OpsFS is that OpsFS, we took the metadata information, so the structure of the file system, directories, where the blocks are located, permissions, and so on, and we moved it outside the memory of the name node process into the into what we call RunDB, which is essentially a distributed in-memory database that it was forked out of MySQL NDB cluster. Specifically MySQL NDB cluster, if you're not familiar, it's not a cluster of MySQLs, but it's actually a different storage layer as well. So it's basically a distributed in-memory layer that basically stores the processed data. And you can do like really nice things. Like you can do like scale up and down online. You can do upgrades and stuff like this. And it's in memory, so it's extremely fast. So moving this metadata information from the actual name zones to database allows us to basically have effectively stateless name nodes in OpsFS. So we can have as many as we want. We can take them down. We can start new ones. Allows us to basically be way more flexible in terms of operations, in terms of management of the entire file system. On the bottom part, we have, let's say, the data management layer. Here we have processes like the data nodes, right? And it's the same concept in HFS. Data nodes are responsible for receiving streams of data from clients and storing them in a local file system, and then give it back essentially, right? They deal with that kind of processes. Here we actually made some modifications, some architectural changes, in a sense that like depending on where you deploy OpsFS, depending on where you're deploying, whether you're deploying on-prem, whether you're deploying on the cloud. You can actually decide to store the actual blocks on like normal like disks, like on the machines, but you can actually store them also on the cloud object stores, right? So you can store them on S3, you can store them on GCS, you can store them on Azure Block Storage, and so on, right? So the data nodes themselves also become stateless essentially, right? And in this case, they have two roles. They have a role of basically not breaking the protocol essentially of the HFS protocol client. And also interacting as a cache, right? So it's every time you write something, and then this is flushed down to the storage layer, so to the object stores, but it's also cached into data node processes themselves, so that if the clients are keep writing and reading the same files, then obviously you don't have to go to the object stores, improving performance quite a lot. The last changes we made are around security, and we're going to talk about a little bit later. But essentially, that's OpsFL in a nutshell. Where it is used? Well, OpsFS is used as part of the the broader platform, which is called OpsWorks. OpsWorks is essentially a data platform for machine learning. Allows you to basically provide a bunch of different things, which probably you're not interested in, to basically manage what we call features in machine learning. So essentially, you know, you take a bunch of data from a bunch of different data sources, you extract like signals to train a model on, and then you're basically storing those signals because the feature engineering process, right, the signal extraction process is quite compute intensive. So you want to store them and reuse them across multiple models and so on. And you know, we have a dual system architecture. We have offline data for more like training new models and doing like batch inference. And then we have some online data for doing real-time operations, right? The OpsFS part is actually this. It's powering the offline feature store part, right? Which is basically saying store all the data, historical data, across many, many years, across more models that is being used for you know, training additional models and so on. Now, the problem that we're facing and the reason we started working on the Fuse file system for OpsFS is the following. Right, so the entire platform, the OpsWorks feature store platform, stands basically in between two different worlds, should we say? Right. So on the other, on one side, we have like more traditional data engineering world, where we have like applications like Spark, Flink, maybe Beam, and so on, which they have been built from day one, essentially supporting the HFS API, supporting the OpsFS API as well. Right. So you can plug it in and they work, essentially. Right. On the other side, on the consumer side of the data of the platform, well, you have the entire data science world, right? And that's mostly basically built on top of Python libraries. And, you know, like they have been built relying on the fact that it's a logger file system, and they don't necessarily interact with distributed file systems, whether it's Apache HFS, but also they don't maybe interact even with like object store or stuff like this, right? They only maybe read data from a logger file system, right? So we can actually have, if you take the libraries on the left, so if you take the libraries that are, let's say, data science library and generally data science processes, we can actually have, you know, two separate scenarios, right? We have a scenario where the libraries actually support what's called like libhfs. Libhfs is essentially a wrapper for it's a JNI wrapper for the clients for the file system. And that allows us basically to actually interact with the file system from a bunch of different libraries, like PyArrow, Pandas, and a bunch more actually do support reading from the reading from HFS or OpsFS through the libhfs library. The problem is that even this scenario still requires access to a JVM, right? And in a world of data science where you know, people used to do pip install a library, and that downloads like a bunch of like zip file and extracting on your local laptop, you know, configuring the JVM, bringing down the JVM, bringing down the OpsFS clients or HFS clients, it's quite cumbersome, right? So that's kind of, it works, but it's not the ideal case scenario, right? The other kind of libraries or tools that are essentially in the other camp, let's say, are tools that do not support libhfs at all. So one of the functionalities that you have in OpsWorks is basically, well, I want to clone a Git repository in OpsWorks so that we can actually run it. And, you know, you can't just run Git on top of HFS or OpsFS, right? So there isn't really like a nice solution there. And so we started working on implementing a Fuse file system for OpsFS. And we actually built it on top of some of the existing work that is open source and it's out there. All the work that we built on top is also open source. So the libraries and the entire application is written in Go. So that obviously removes the need for a JVM. And it's built on basically three different projects. The first one is the Fuse library itself, so implementing the interface for the Fuse file system. The second one is the OpsFS Go client, which is actually built on the HFS project from Colin Mark, which essentially implements the entire protocol for communicating with the HFS or OpsFS, but using Go, right? So you can actually interact with the file system without the need of a JVM, and then basically bring everything together in the OpsFS Go mount project, which is actually forked from a project that Microsoft started working on, the HFS mount project. By the time we forked it and started working on it, it was pretty much a POC. I think it was only allowing like read operation or something, and then you know, some on the team kind of expanded really nicely to be able to support much more. Now, the implementation of this solution actually has a bunch of different challenges, and there are two essentially group of challenges, right? One is the API difference, what is the APIs that like OpsFS and HFS actually provide, and what the APIs that, you know, the, like, you know, POSIX API that are required by tools like Git and so on. And then the second one is a completely different security model, right? So we're going to look at how we bridge the gap between the two in the implementation, essentially, right? So the first part is HFS is append only, right? So when you create a file, you cannot go in the middle of the file and add additional content, right? You can only append things to the file, right? And so this doesn't work. If you open Vim and you know editing stuff around, then you can't actually just, you know, write directly to HFS or OpsFS. As I said, doesn't support random writes. It does not support multiple writers. So when you open a file for write, you actually get a list on the file, and you are the only one that can actually write there, right? And nobody else can actually write, which is not the behavior that you expect from the POSIX API. The other aspect is the block size is quite huge. So that's like, you know, the blocks on OpsFS and HFS are configurable. You can make them as small as possible, but like the default behavior is to be quite big. It's like 6428 megabytes, because the access path and the write patterns make it that it's much more performant to do that. And then we're going to talk about the security model in a second, right? So how does the system work, right? So we have two scenarios, essentially. We have a read scenario, read-only mode, or like read and write scenario. For the read-only mode, it's actually quite trivial. What basically happens, actually, I can show this diagram. I don't know if you can actually see from the back. But essentially what happens is that the process actually talks to the OpsFS fuse mount and asks, I want to read this file. Because the API from HFS and OpsFS allow you to basically, you know, do seeks and read and stuff like this, they are compatible. We can just forward the request to the remote storage, essentially, right? So you open a file, we open a file, you read a set amount of bytes from a set amount of position, that is mapped to operations directly in OpsFS. So that's pretty trivial to implement. The writing scenario is a little bit more complicated for the reasons I was mentioning earlier. So at the high level, what happens is that the remote file gets copied on the local file system, and we write it in a staging area. And so the processes, like the Linux processes, are actually gonna write to this like staging replica of the file. And then when either the file is flushed or the file is closed, then we actually upload the file back into the remote storage. So it looks like a little bit like this. You open the file, and we open the file. You actually get back, we don't download the file immediately, even if you ask for writing and open the file in writing. And the most, like, the reason is people are lazy, essentially, right? In the sense of, like, when they open a file, like, say you want to check out, you want to look at the file, and, you know, you might open Vim and open a file, and then at that point, you know, you don't want to write anything, but you have opened it, read and write. And because file and OpsFS are generally pretty large, we don't want to, you know, keep downloading random file for absolutely no reason, right? So what basically happens is that we delay the download of the file until the first write comes in. When the first write comes in, the write is intercepted, and we basically, the first thing we do is basically download the file into the staging area, where from there we can actually do the operations, right? Now, all the operations that happen, like all the read operation, all the write operation, do not go to the remote storage anymore, but they actually act on the local version of the file. And, you know, this allows us to basically, you know, write random stuff at a random point in time, sorry, random place in the file, allows us to basically have multiple writers writing files, multiple readers, and so on. So they all write as if it was like a local file, essentially, which it is, right? What happens is at some point someone was going to call a sync, or, you know, call a sync and then close the file. And what's going to happen is that when the sync happens, then the file is then back uploaded into the remote storage, right? And that basically allows us to add the file in OpsFS. When the last client the last write client actually closes the file, then we can actually remove the file from the staging directory, right? So if you have like five different clients working on it, and then you know one removes it, then we can let the last one closes it, then we can remove the file from the staging directory. Now the last part, the last difference in terms of like compatibility between what the OpsFS and HFS API are and the local file system are. Can I take the questions a little bit later? Or, okay. This way?
Later.
Okay, thanks. So in that regard is so the way the security works on OpsFS is slightly different than if you're familiar with HFS. You might be familiar with Kerberos. In OpsWorks, we don't use Kerberos, we use certificates. So every user in the platform gets a certificate, or actually gets more than the one, but it doesn't matter. Essentially, in the certificate itself, we have the information about who the user is, and every time the user needs to do an operation with the file system and any other service in OpsWorks, present a certificate, and the certificate is obviously verified based on the chain of trust that is established within OpsWorks deployment. So this is basically what happens at the high level, right? So every time the OpsFS fuse mount needs to talk to the OpsFS remote storage, it has to present a certificate essentially. And this is something that we control in the way that we actually use the OpsFS fuse mount in OpsWorks. When we set up the mount point, we actually make sure that the mount point is set up with the certificates for that specific user, so that if I need access to a specific directory from a Python library, OpsWorks set up the mount point and provision the certificate for my user, so that someone else cannot necessarily use the same mount point and the same certificates. So this is controlled at the application level, not necessarily the storage layer. All the operations that happen on this side, well, are the authenticated based on the certificate. The problem happens from, let's say, the OpsFS fuse mount to the user side, to the let's say Linux processes essentially, right? So what happens here is the following. So there is a mapping going on between the users in OpsFS and the user on the machine, right? The problem that this setup has is that you end up having a lot of users on OpsFS, right? Our deployments might have 5,000 users all on the same deployment. That results in way more groups than 5,000, and so we cannot spend time and create them all the users, all the groups on the machines. So the way we actually work in this situation is that when the OpsWorks application needs access to a mount point, it provisions that mount point. It also makes sure it doesn't mount the entire file system. It mounts a specific subdirectory. And when it mounts a specific subdirectory before mounting it, it provisions the users that are within the own files within that specific subdirectory. And the way it knows that is because in OpsWorks, directories have a specific meanings. They are organized in a specific way, and so OpsWorks application knows which users are have access to a specific subdirectory. So before actually mounting the file system, we actually provision all the users, provision all the groups. And then what basically OpsFS mount does is that, a file here is owned by user Fabio, so there is a user on the machine, user Fabio, with a specific UID. So the user ID of that file is going to be the same, essentially. And again, the provisioning of the user is controlled by the OpsFS application when it's necessary, essentially. Now, there are a couple of, I would say, unsupported capabilities and things that we plan to address in the future, or like limitations, essentially. One thing that are not supported at the moment are links, both hard and soft links. OpsFS has support for soft links in the background, but we never really used them in OpsWorks, so we didn't have support here in OpsFS mount either. The challenge we have is around the usage of disk caches. So essentially, if you're working with a local file system, the kernel does a pretty aggressive caching of the data and so on. The problem we have is that OpsWorks is a multi-tenant platform, so we have multiple users working on the potentially the same files. And so caching the files becomes a little bit problematic, because if you have two users working on the same file, then it, like, the different mount points are not going to be able to talk to each other and say, hey, there is something has changed here, and you need to reflect that in your cache. So at the moment, the caches are kind of disabled, but we're working on some solution to be able to get notifications and figure out that files have changed, right? The reason they don't know is because there's different mount points, because each mount point has its own certificate for that specific user, right? So the users are not sharing the same mount point. So changes, one user making changes is going to talk to a different mount point than another user making changes, essentially. The other thing that happens, if we go back to the write operation, when we upload the file, we upload the entire file. So there is no concept of uploading a specific block. The HFS API and the OpsFS API does not allow you to basically say, I know that like a specific block has changed, I'm going to just replace that specific block, right? So this operation, if you're working with very, very large files, then might become a problem. For the use cases that we use OpsFS mount within the OpsOx platform, this is not a problem. Users are working with like small Python applications, or like generally speaking, smaller files. Or when they are dealing with bigger files, they are dealing in a read process, not necessarily in a writing. I'm not going to end up writing a Parquet file in Vim, like several gigabytes of Parquet files. So that's kind of it. That's kind of where we stand. If you have any questions, I can take them now. Thank you very much.
Do you in practice have problems with applications ignoring the return value of close?
Return value of close? Not necessarily. So the question is, if we have problems with applications ignoring the return value of close, not at the moment, no. The way we use OpsFS mount is basically we mount inside Docker containers. For instance, when you're doing, if you're running Jupyter notebooks or if you're running Git applications and so on, and we shut down the entire process. Usually, shut down the entire container essentially, right? So when the files get closed and everything gets closed, shut down the entire mount point essentially. That's because not necessarily because it's necessary, but that's because usually that's the user experience and that people have in general.
But you can't guarantee that the upload actually worked.
You can't guarantee. Come again? Sorry.
The last step.
Yes.
What happens if the upload file fails?
If the upload file fails, try again. And then eventually, it's at some point we give up, yeah. Yeah.
So I assume that there are two machines that try to write, open for writing and write through the same file independently. So obviously one of them wins and takes the lease and does download of the file, modification, and upload.
Yeah.
What happens with the other machine? So what does the process that tries to open the file for writing at the same time and write to it observes?
In this case, the last write wins. Like that's the problem that we have here, right? It's basically saying if we have like multiple machines mounting the same directory, they can't like, and we are writing on the same file. The mount point doesn't know that like you are changing the same, like my mount point doesn't know that you're changing the same file. So we upload the file, and then you upload the file as well, and your write space essentially wins essentially. And then, can we get? No, nobody's waiting for another one. But you end up in a weird situation where I might not be able to see immediately your changes, and so I might be able to, I might resave my file and re-upload my file, so then your changes get overwritten again. So it becomes a little bit like this. Yeah.
Thanks. You make a few references, all of us, to HFS.
Yeah.
And you said that the Fuse implementation is based on the projects that were issued with for HFS.
Yeah.
Would it be possible to use?
Sorry. Good question. In general, yes. You might not have like the security part of the. We didn't implement the Kerberos part of the security, right? So if you have a secure cluster, then you're probably not going to be able to use it. You implement the Kerberos part. Yeah. Yeah. There was a question in the back.
So you said that sharing this file together, right?
Now there are processes. Thank you. The question is whether or not there are processes sharing the file. There are processes sharing the file, but you have the problem is that you have multiple users writing on the same file on different processes that do not know about each other.
Yes, I understand. I have one more question. What about the directory metadata? It's also shared between users.
It's also shared between users. No, it's like the different mount points are there. The question was about the directory metadata. It's also it's independent with it's independent with each other.
So users they don't share directory metadata, so that means that they don't share mount points.
They don't share mount points, no.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you create a file, then but if you do a LS operation, then we go back to the file system and that is reflected. But they're not necessarily relying on the mount point, relying on the OPSFS mount going back to the remote storage to get the new directory structure and so on. Yeah.
With this staged file writing, I imagine that improves read performance for the client too, right? When it's actually a downloaded local file, and do people use that? Like, do they do a little write and then just get quick downloads?
It does. It does. That's one of the. Oh, that's one of the other reasons. We kind of the question. The question is around the read performance when you're reading a file that you have like stored locally in the stage directory. It does. We don't have a specific number, but I have some user experience with that. When you have files that are on the remote storage. Even if they are especially if they are smaller files, like a Jupyter notebook, this JSON file, maybe a megabyte maximum or something, then it's the override of going and fetching it every time. It's quite significant. If you have it locally, it's much more. You can see it much more reactive.
Might be a nice feature.
Yeah, there was a.
I thought you said you deleted the staging file as soon as you closed it.
Yes.
But you keep it as a.
No, but if you have it open when you keep writing it, then when you read it, you're not going to the remote storage. You're reading from the local staging directory, right? So the only time is if you're doing some read only operations essentially, then at that point we don't download it, mostly because. In general, we are working with pretty large files, and so the downloading process might not be necessary, right? Because if you open, let's say, a Parquet file, what happens is that you go at the end of the file, you just read the footer to figure out the schema, figure out where you need to go, and if maybe it's like a 4 gigabytes Parquet file, you don't want to download 4 gigabytes to read that, maybe a couple of megabytes of metadata, essentially. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.